You can lose, but I know how you love to win. Break my damn down and pick me like a javelin. Whoa, you said.
We'd like to welcome everybody back to the Rock Under Fire podcast.
Rock Under Fire!
You can find us over at rockunderfire.com, Rock Under Fire at iTunes. Like us over on our Facebook page. Subscribe to us on YouTube. You can also find us on Stitcher. Mike DiRico here with Pat Ivanitsky and Stick Nixon.
What's going on, boys? It's been a while.
Yeah.
It's been about a month, hasn't it, since our last show?
And we want to thank everybody for being patient during our month-long absence.
Lots of cards and letters saying, where are you? Where you been?
Right before the election.
Postcards. We read your mail. And we want to welcome any new listeners who may have joined us since our last episode. We are a rock and roll podcast. We dissect and discuss and analyze and argue 7 decades of rock and roll music.
And we attack.
We attack.
We're not afraid to go on the attack.
It's a broad.
No, say hard truths.
A very broad
inconvenient truths.
Where we create our big mess on. And sometimes we create masterpieces, and other times it unravels like a long roll of toilet paper.
Have we created masterpieces?
Yes, we have.
Our opus.
That's right. The last one unraveled like a long roll of toilet
paper.
Yeah,
that one did.
You know, like you said, though, in the post on Facebook, the cards are just against us. I was sick. I wasn't even here. Yep. I was going to be talking on the phone. It's just, I don't know. It's odd without the three of us being in the room doing the podcast together. It was very strange.
Several people were just like, you know, are you really going to do that? You're going to go there? You really want to go get into politics? And we talked about it. It was the week of the election. I think it was the Friday after, and we talked, and we were just like, you know, like we have to go here. We've got to go there. It's just everybody was seething.
It's a good subject.
Over the election, and there was just a lot
people
of
people are just ready to like
heated bad blood
kick in your door and put a gun in your face. Is this the United States we're living in?
It's very awkward. I think it was just the whole thing about people criticizing artists for expressing their views, and that just, you know, there's a topic in that. There's a discussion in that, and, you know, like Pat said, you know, it was just kind of the cards were against us. You know, there was a couple of cancellations, and then when we finally got together, we had Pat on the phone because he was sick as a dog.
Sick as shit.
Then we had some technical glitches. And it just wasn't meant to be.
Serious technical glitches.
Stick and I were sitting here talking after we got off the phone with you, and we made 3 or 4 attempts at a show, and it just kept breaking down, and we just looked at each other, and we were like, these are just omens. This is a sign that, like, we are not supposed to do this episode, and somebody is trying to tell us something.
The ghost of John F. Kennedy himself. You will not record a podcast about politics and music.
Error.
I just want to start with a what's going on real quick, because I was on the phone.
That's how we start the show. What's going on?
I was going to try and get
what's
it out there. I finally got to see Billy Joel at Madison Square Garden.
That's right.
I guess this has been the year of me to see the big ones. You know, I saw Bruce. I saw Billy. Next year, actually, I'm going to see the Dead just for the sake of seeing the Dead.
You have tickets?
Dead and Company. Yeah, my buddy got the
tickets
yesterday.
Too cool, man. Too cool.
Going to go check them out in Camden. I'd like to see John Mayer and Bob and Weir. You know, I want to see what's going on there.
You'll enjoy that.
I think I will.
It's not your thing.
As a musician. Right. Yeah, it's not my thing. But from a musician's standpoint, I feel like I should at least go out there. And then I can back any critique I may have up.
And thanks to Mayer, too, they're going more in a blues direction, less in a psychedelic direction. That might be...
You know, I've seen John Mayer. He opened for Counting Crows, and this is when, like, I guess it was his first record, and it was very popish, bubblegumish. And then he really started getting back to his roots and has put out some great music other than, like, if you throw away his first two records... From that point
that
forward,
was my first
I'm like,
impressions
whoa.
Of
yeah,
John Mayer.
I mean, the John Mayer Trio has really some good stuff.
I've seen John Mayer play guitar. You know, I'm not a fan of his music, but again, just my impression of John Mayer was, again, just what I first heard, like everybody else. I'm just kind of like, you know what, this is not for me. I've seen him play guitar. I just mad respect for the guy.
Yeah, he's tremendous. But not to get off point, but Billy Joel was phenomenal. He treated Madison Square Garden like you were sitting in a small club, you know, addressing the crowd.
Yeah.
What sucked is it was a Monday night because it was rescheduled. I had the tickets for September. He had some throat surgery. and they rescheduled it for fucking Thanksgiving week, Monday night. So the crowd was like, eh, how do you get up for a Monday
still
night
got,
concert?
Still got turkey tryptophan in your body Monday was, night after Thanksgiving? Yeah,
no, it was right before. It was prior, right before, yeah. But but he treated the crowd like it was a small little venue, and you know, he was talking to us and stuff. He told a story on how Bruce broke down. That's the bike that Billy Joel's company made. He owns a motorcycle shop in Long Island.
What's Bruce's connection? You said Bruce?
Yeah, when Bruce Springsteen broke down in Freehold on his motorcycle.
Oh, yeah.
Billy's place built that bike.
Really?
Yeah, he broke out into a little Born to Run. I mean, he just had fun with the crowd. You know, Down East to Relax. It did a lot asked the crowd like what they wanted to hear, more or less. It was just a really, really all around good show. And it's, I mean, what don't you know by Billy Joel? You know most of his catalog already.
Oh, hell yeah.
You know?
Is Billy Joel a seminal artist for you? Someone real near and dear to your heart? Is he on your top 25?
I think he would be in that top 25.
I know he would for Mike.
He always reminds me. He always brings me back to my childhood. I know I've mentioned before Fleetwood Mac did, the Eagles did.
Yeah,
and Billy has that kind of same hold.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, his really older stuff. It was what was on the radio then.
Yeah,
you know?
A lot of people seem to feel that way. I don't know if I've ever met a person who was singularly fanatical about him, like a Billy Joel freak. Like, yeah, that's my guy. Like, I don't know if I've ever met anyone who was Bruce has guys like that. Even Bob has a few weirdos that just are really into him and him, you know, exclusively. Billy Joel, I don't meet those type of people too much.
Would he have that kind of people? You know, would he have those
Why
kind of
not?
People?
Why wouldn't he?
I guess he does somewhere. But Long Island,
I think every artist has
the
Steely Dan.
Yeah.
You know, I remember in 2009 when I first, I came late to Steely Dan. I got really, really got into them. It was the summer of 2009. And I was, you know, the Beacon shows were coming up. And it was the first time they were playing their album straight through. And I remember going on some message board. I'll never remember what it was. And it would just like die hard. So you could tell, like, well, they did this last night, but they didn't do this. And, I got that in Boston. And I was at the Charlotte, North Carolina show, and they did that, you know. And there are people. So there's got to be a certain percentage of his crowd that... You would think.
You put it like that, there is when I was trying to find out what songs he was playing in set lists.
Right.
And I was looking up set lists prior to our show, and it was like that. Oh, he played this that night. Oh, he played that. You know, there were a few comments like that.
Yeah.
And for the most part, he did a... You know, there were some things that he hasn't done that he did, and there's some things that he's been doing that he didn't do for us. So
he's got such a diversity of hits that he can afford to leave some off. Like, we didn't get... XYZ, you know, you're not going to get it all.
And he dug into the catalog. I really wanted to hear Down East or Alexa, and he played it, and I was very happy about that. But he has been playing that song, so I was happy that he still did that. You know, it was really
Can't
hot. When he came out for the first encore, it was the first song was Uptown Girl. But he walks out.
I love that one.
I do like it, actually. You know, after I heard it, I was like, oh, wow, I do like this song. But he came out with his Grammy Award, and he put his Grammy down on the piano. And I'm like, wow, what the hell is he going to do? And he broke out into Uptown Girl, and he's doing, like, all these little poses. He's kind of throwing a little shot at Christie Brinkley, you know, like, mocking her and shit like that. And yeah, it was very interesting to see, because the song was written exclusively for her. And it was just very interesting to see. It was like, you know, you stick your Uptown Girl up your ass, more or less, you know. And he had a guy singing with him on that. His guitar player can sing opera, because they did, like, this little small piece of an opera song that I have no clue what it would be. You can play it for me again. I probably wouldn't even recognize it.
Yeah.
The guy had a tremendous voice. And on Uptown Girl, he doubled Billy. So they really had that punch, because that's a higher register
song.
Yeah, he's his guitar player, rhythm guitar player, backup singer.
When Billy Joel recorded The Innocent Man, his 1983 album, he did he went back and he kind of wore all of his influences on his sleeve.
Yeah.
And he did, you know, the Longest Time was a doo-wop song.
Yep. Did that too.
Uptown Girl was it was written for Christie, but the music wise, it was a little tribute to Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons with the falsetto.
Right.
And he wrote it as if it were, he was channeling a Bob Gaudio composition. The whole Bob Crewe production, and what Bob Crewe used to do was double their voices to make it that thick, syrupy smack in the face. Mm. And I would imagine that him bringing that guitarist out to do that part.
You know, he was doing it more than once. So he did it on other songs, too. I mean, Billy clearly isn't... he can't hit that higher stuff that he was able to. And when I noticed him doing that, I said, all right, I want to keep my eye on this. And he did it multiple times. What do you call it? Does it in Bon Jovi? I don't know his name. The keyboard player?
Is it?
He sings the exact same.
What is that guy's name anyway?
David Bryan.
That's it.
He sings Brian the exact something. Same tracks that John is singing. They sing together now. He doesn't even sing because John can't even sing his own shit anymore.
Oh, they sing the same note now.
Yeah, note for note.
Yeah.
Howard Stern was actually talking about it. He goes, it was odd to see, but it sounded good.
Sounds good, right?
I guess.
Yeah.
But that was my what's going on, and it's been almost, 3 weeks since I've seen him. And,
Well, at least you went to a rock concert.
Yeah.
That's cool.
I haven't been listening to rock lately. I've been listening to A Tribe Called Quest has a new album out. I know you guys are looking at me like I got six heads.
I don't care, man.
They are. You like what you like. This record is great.
The new record is great?
It might be the album of the year.
Really?
I believe it.
Yeah. It might be the album of the year. It's like being on a futuristic journey. It's so fucking good.
Wow.
And I know Nirenberg, if you're out there listening, you probably love it as well.
I agree with what Mike said. If it sounds good, it is good.
Yeah.
I've been listening to a lot of jazz lately.
So really?
I'm just like not even on the rock and roll map right now.
Kind
of all over the place.
Yeah, so for my what's going on, man, I want to do something a little different, man. But we haven't been on the air in a while, guys, you know? It was like a month ago, I think, first week in November, while it was still decent out, not cold out. Me and the chick went to the zoo. You know, we did the Bronx Zoo. We go into the gorilla habitat, start checking out the gorillas. That leads to us talking about that situation in Cincinnati.
Harambe.
You know the name, Harambe the gorilla, right?
Yeah.
This kid falls into the gorilla pit in the Cincinnati Zoo. Everybody freaks out. The guys ain't taking no chances. So they shot Harambe, right, in order to protect the kid, even though the gorilla wasn't really attacking the kid.
Yeah.
Well, we can talk about that. But it's got me thinking about Cincinnati, you know? You know, here on Rock Under Fire, we're not afraid to go after rock stars, you know? We'll go right at you. We're not afraid to tell Bob it's time to hang it up, right? Stop charging people outrageous amounts of money to see you. Kiss, you guys look fat behind your makeup. But a city we don't really go after. So I got to thinking about Cincinnati. You know, I always want to know, like, what music comes from certain places. Like, what has Cincinnati given us in terms of artists, you know?
Okay.
Always interested in knowing who comes from where. Yeah, Detroit's got, you know, your MC5, Iggy Pop, Connection to Kiss. You know?
Seeger.
Seeger. That's a big one, man. You know? I can go on and on. But I had to look up who comes from Cincinnati. You know, can you think of anyone offhand that comes from Cincinnati? A famous star?
Cincinnati Chili?
Cincinnati.
Well, that's all right. I'm glad you said that. Cincinnati Chili. Stop right there. Pat, do you know what Cincinnati Chili is?
Soylent Brown.
I do not.
This is the signature dish of the city of Cincinnati is Cincinnati chili. It's the worst.
It's weapons of mass destruction.
That's right, man. It's chili. Right? It's chili with heavy cinnamon in it and chocolate, I think. And you throw it over a big dish of spaghetti, and they own it like Philly owns the cheesesteak. They're proud of it. It's awful.
Spaghetti.
It's awful.
God almighty, wake up, Cincinnati.
I think that's a big cultural contribution to Western civilization.
I think you better send Todd to Cincinnati and take care of that problem quick.
Yeah, you know. At least Todd's got good cheese in Wisconsin.
Yeah. I'm waiting for the punchline.
I can't think of a band. I can't think of a band or an artist from Cincinnati. I can't.
They got the Bengals. Don't even get me started.
Were they from Cincinnati?
Cincinnati Bengals. Not the Bengals.
Oh,
the Bengals.
The sports
football team.
I thought you meant the Bengals, the girls. I'm like,
nah,
from Cincinnati?
Nothing like that. But did you have the Bengals, which is another reason to get ticked off at Cincinnati. Still waiting for that first Super Bowl ring after all these years.
They had the Reds, the big red machine.
Reds were cool. They're a cool team.
Pete Rose is their rock star.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is. Cincinnati's got
Marge Schott is their Ted Nugent.
Yeah. She definitely was their Ted Nugent. That's a great one.
Detroit's got Motown. Iggy Pop, like I said, MC5. Cleveland's got Hallowed Ground. It's got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Chicago's got Wrigley Field.
Numerous
blues. Brothers.
Home of the original Dog Pound, man, in Cleveland.
Yeah.
The real Dog Pound.
The real Dog Pound.
Municipal Stadium.
Yep. What else, man? Chicago-style blues, like you said, comes from, you know. But Cincinnati gave us no such thing. You know who comes from Cincinnati? Marty Ballin from Jefferson Airplane.
Okay.
Comes from Cincinnati.
All right, Marty Ballin. All right, Cincinnati, man.
The Isley Brothers are actually very cool. They come from Cincinnati.
All right.
Isley Brothers are great. That's it. That's completely it.
That's it?
There's no one else.
So it means we gotta rely even more on Cesar Cedeno.
Yeah.
Dave Concepcion.
Well, you know, here's some
Foster, George Foster.
I didn't stop there. All right, who comes from Cincinnati? John Boehner, former Speaker of the House. crying guy. He's very emotional, that guy. Crying all the time. Former President Howard Taft, famous for being corpulent.
The president?
Howard Taft from Cincinnati.
Taft, man. That's the guy that was so fat they had to call the fire department to come and cut him out of the bathtub.
He's a big dude.
he got stuck in the bathtub.
He did, right?
Yeah.
Bring him out in a sling.
Sure. But he busted more trusts than Teddy Roosevelt.
All right.
And he was the big trust bust.
So we like Taft then. We like Taft?
Well, I mean, you know, he was.
Taft is too close to Trump. Please continue.
Move on.
Jerry Springer comes from Cincinnati, and I'm not hating on Jerry. All right. The Naked Cowboy, who walks around Manhattan, is actually originally from Cincinnati.
He was on Howard, too. That guy's a nut job.
And finally, you know who's from Cincinnati?
Too much of that fucking chili.
Yeah, he's nuts, man. Finally, from Cincinnati, guys, is Charles Manson.
Whoa.
Charlie Manson. So, you know what? For giving us a lot of very mediocre rock, terrible food, terrible football. Cincinnati, you're under fire.
And one of the most horrible human beings to ever walk the planet Earth.
Which one?
Charlie Manson.
Charlie?
Thank you, Cincinnati.
That was awesome.
That was great. That was a nice little segment. I liked it a lot. You know it's good when all three of us just fucking jump on it and start fucking hammering away on it.
You guys are looking at me. I'm projecting. Are we okay?
When Mike does this. We know we're
in trouble. Did this, man. I never once did this. Oh, man. He's moving around.
He's eyeing you up.
Yeah, he wants to kill me.
The listeners know there's live snakes in Rock Under Fire Studios.
There are. I'm looking at
Do the people know?
Python, right?
The studio is actually in a serpentarium, and that is a fact. It's no joke.
Yeah, maybe he likes Cincinnati or something. He's a chili fan.
Man. He's from Cincinnati.
He's from Cincinnati.
Fucking snake's got a Cincinnati accent.
Hey, what are you talking about my city for?
You see this? You see this Coke over here? This is not Coke. This is not soda. This is pop.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what do we got? We got a topic, Mikey, or what?
Sometimes in the arts, we have, we have marriages of mediums that kind of lend themselves to the longevity of a piece of art or to the artists themselves. I'll give you a quick example, and then we'll get to our topic. Photography. Photography and music.
Huge.
Two mediums that kind of go together, man, like peanut butter and jelly. And, think about all of the great photographs that have been taken in music, in rock and roll, and any music, man. Think about the middle finger Johnny Cash picture.
A lot of them are like from the five photographers.
Or, Paul and the Clash smashing his bass guitar on the stage of the Palladium, man, becomes the cover of the Clash's London Calling album.
John and Yoko in bed.
John with the New York City t-shirt, man. You know, just
Kiss on a Rooftop.
It's
Jim Morrison.
What would rock music be without the photographers?
And the photographers are rock
stars,
too.
The guys who take the pictures, man. So this is a topic that we're going to come across in the next couple months. We're going to do a show on this, on photography and rock. But the other marriage of mediums is film and music. What would film be without the music? Think of the best movies you've ever seen, the best movies that... of all time, or even, you know, just the critically praised ones and the ones that you just love. And think about those movies without the music.
In preparation for this episode, I actually looked up Rolling Stone's idea of the top 25 movie soundtracks of all time, and it's an interesting list. I'll throw a couple nuggets out there as we discuss this subject. Some of them I definitely agree with. Some of them I'm like, eh. But, you know.
What about... All right, yeah, that's just fine, but don't you have a couple soundtracks in your collection at home that you just love?
Oh, they're actually on the list, believe it or not. I mean, Rolling Stone, for all that Rolling Stone is, I don't enjoy the magazine. I haven't enjoyed the magazine since they put the Unabomber, that fucking Boston Bomber on their cover. I was done with them at that point.
I understand how you feel.
but there sometimes their foot is in reality, and this is one of those instances where there's a couple of soundtracks on it that I absolutely love.
Yeah.
One I would rank higher than it is. Two of them, actually, I would probably rank higher than they have them, but they're definitely out there. I have probably three off the top of my head that I can... Okay, this is my go-to soundtrack.
What is it? What's your go-to?
Oh, my go-to is Pulp Fiction, without any hesitation. That's the go-to movie soundtrack for me. Mm-hmm. Had a little bit of everything. From Urge Overkill to Chuck Berry to... I mean, it was to the fucking Kool and the Gang. It was a fantastic album. Right. Fantastic album.
I think with Quentin Tarantino, you can't go wrong. He's famous for his soundtracks.
What he wants to put in a movie, absolutely.
And I think most people probably go to Pulp Fiction first. But you ever hear Kill Bill? Outstanding. And you know what? The one I love best, my favorite Quentin Tarantino soundtrack, underrated movie too, is Jackie Brown. Hmm. Jackie Brown is a smooth and soulful man. I just love it, man.
There was so much pressure on that movie because it was his second one out of the gate. And what's he going to do next after Pulp Fiction? I agree with you. Very underrated movie. Loved it. I loved that movie. Brought Michael Keaton back to the planet again.
Yeah.
The guy was dead, basically, and he brought him right back into the forefront again.
They got that Brothers Johnson Strawberry Letter 22. You know that tune? Strawberry
Good stuff, man.
Letter 22. Ooh, beautiful.
It seems like directors. I texted Laura before. She asked what our topic was, and we were talking about soundtracks. And she mentioned Boogie Nights, and she said, "Well, Boogie Nights has like a lot more music than your average movie." And that got me thinking. Like, you know, in the '90s, in the mid to late '90s, there seems to have been a trend where directors almost built the movie. And I know this isn't totally true, but it almost seemed like certain scenes were almost built around the music. Like certain scenes were meant for certain songs, whereas songs were meant for certain scenes. You know, it was almost like
very true.
You know,
in Boogie Nights in particular,
especially in that movie,
certain directors in the '90s, they seem to have gotten on this trend, and Tarantino is one of them.
Paul Thomas Anderson is another one. Wes Anderson.
Yeah.
And she had a point. I was like, you know what? Now that you mention that, I was like, there really seemed to be that sort of a trend.
I always confuse the part of the movie, but when Alfred Molina, when they're sitting on the couch and they're trying to buy those drugs, is it Sister Christian that he's singing? I thought it was Night Ranger.
It was Sister Christian, kind of playing the air drums, rocking out in a robe and stuff.
He's all coked up out of his mind. It just really,
oh, it's great.
Like you said, I think the scene was built around the song. You know what I mean? That's a great point.
Things are just meant, you know. Yeah.
The Stones in, was it Goodfellas? Children, it's just a shadow away. What is it? Give Me Shelter. Right?
Yeah. Isn't
that,
yeah.
That song, just when it comes up in that movie, you're just like, whoa. And he's all.
Yeah.
Coked out of his mind, and he's like looking for helicopters and freaking out. Yeah. It just fits so well. I think Marty Scorsese is second only to Quentin Tarantino in that.
He used the Stones very effectively, man.
The Stones
were meant for his films, man, especially in the '90s.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Steve.
I was just saying, Goodfellas too. One song that really works is Harry Nilsson. We Can Make Each Other Happy. Remember, he's driving. That's the chase scene, man. When he's all coked out in the car with the helicopter above him.
Yeah,
great.
Right. Yeah, the Stones one was when they were starting to whack everybody.
Yeah,
they were starting to smoke everybody. But that movie in particular goes from like. The '50s, and it goes all the way up to like, you know, to current time, and he strategically places those songs in that movie, and it was just really well done. And then if you go older than that, like Apocalypse Now, I mean, that was another one that had some really good Vietnam era music in it.
Wagner.
That's the best, man. I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Yeah.
Give me back my board. That was a good board.
You know, it was the first time I heard The End by The Doors. Yeah, I mean, what was that? We were 9 when Apocalypse Now came out.
Jumpin' Jack Flash in that, too.
And it wasn't until Satisfaction when they're surfing.
Or when they're water skiing.
It took, I guess I was 11 when Apocalypse Now finally came on cable. And
I give you credit, though. From a very early age, you were talking about Apocalypse Now. What a great movie it was.
Fantastic.
When you were like 9 or 10, you were talking
about that. It was one of the first movies that I saw on cable. Remember when HBO first came to Ford's?
Right.
And it was a Sunday night, and I remember turning on the TV, and my parents were upstairs, and I remember turning the TV on and like, being both blown away and horrified at the same time when I heard the word fuck coming out of my television speakers. And I was like, whoa! You know, my parents are upstairs. I'm like, I've turned the sound down just in case they heard it because I was going to get in trouble. You know,
you get in trouble for this on the movie.
For what they said on the movie.
Exactly. They just say fuck in that movie. That's a bad.
But yeah, that's...
She had to repeat it back to you too. No, well, you just said it. I'm going to throw a newer one out there, and it actually is on the Rolling Stone list. Cameron Crowe does some really good stuff.
I know what you're going to say.
Singles. I like Singles. I know you're probably going to go the other one.
No, I know what you're going to say.
I love Singles. I think that was a
great Singles.
Soundtrack.
Okay.
Yeah, you were thinking of the other movie, which is good in its own.
Well, Cameron Crowe's got a lot, but I'm thinking a Tiny Dancer.
Tiny Dancer,
on
yeah. No, know, the Bus.
The Bus, yeah.
What the hell was that? Rock, not Rockstar.
Almost famous.
But before that was Singles, and I dug the soundtrack. That was the whole Seattle thing. It was really just one little area. But the artists on the album were all red hot at the time, and it was good soundtrack.
I saw it once. Only once.
But
missing out.
I got to get into this, though, because we've already mentioned Boogie Nights. That came in at number 18 on Rolling Stone's list.
Mm-hmm.
We all have also mentioned...
Now, let me ask you really quick. Sorry.
That's all
right. Is Rolling Stone's list primarily a rock and roll?
No.
It's just music.
Music.
Okay, so my number one may actually be on Rolling Stone's list?
Maybe.
Okay.
What's your number one?
Cool. Since this isn't a list
show. Let's do it. We'll hold off on the list until the end.
All right, listen.
See what
for me,
didn't.
I make no, it's no secret that Saturday Night Fever is in my top 10
to be there.
Movies of all time. I think it's that good. I think it's one of the 10 greatest American films ever made. I think the soundtrack is one of the great pop albums. It's mostly disco.
Yeah.
But it is one of my very favorite albums ever.
It wouldn't have been
as
successful as it was if it wasn't that good.
It stands up. I mean, as far as, and we're just talking pop music. We're not talking rock. We're not talking, you know, which is pop music in general, which is a broad spectrum. But side one alone, man, is one of the most perfect album sides ever put to vinyl.
Side
and we're
one,
talking
Yvonne,
you know,
is she on side one?
She closes out side one, but it's pretty much the first
right here,
the first four songs are the Bee Gees, which were all like number one songs.
They
man.
Exploded after that album.
And Yvonne is the last song.
The last track. Oh, there it is. Look at that.
Side one is Staying Alive. How Deep Is Your Love? If I Can't Have You, that's Yvonne.
Now the fifth of Beethoven, that's deceiving because that's not side one. That's not side one.
Oh, is that
this
how it is?
This is just
it's
basically
up.
Thrown around.
I hate it when they do that.
Yeah. Side one is basically Staying Alive, How Deep Is Your Love, If I Can't Have You, Night Fever, and let's see, More Than a Woman.
That's so, a perfect album side.
Now, that's just the new music that was created for the movie. The other stuff.
They had
like
other
jive,
older stuff. Yeah.
Jive Talking and You Should Be Dancing and stuff like that. I mean, this is like they went back in the Bee Gees catalog. Do a shot. subliminal B word.
Ah, yeah. I would speak in equally glowing terms about my number one soundtrack. I think it's one of the great American films. The music is absolutely great. Movie changed my life. My favorite movie. You know it's coming.
Oh, man.
Blues Brothers.
You know what? I should have
forgot about
that.
The Blues Brothers.
I know. I did know that, man. Totally forgot.
That's a fucking great movie. Great album. Great choice.
I really tried not to go online and look at lists, man. I wanted to stick with my own collection. I did like a brainstorming, and I forgot about the most
that
important
really
one.
That really is solid, man.
You know what? And this... I can't be the only guy like this, man. I'm a kid. We're into whatever we're into. For me, it was heavy metal. And the Blues Brothers movie comes out, and a whole musical side of me awakens, man. Yeah. My soulful
side.
I'll vouch for that
this guy was digging the Blues Brothers. Not just the movie, but the soundtrack heavily when we were like 11, 12 years old.
I was the same way. Mm-hmm. My mother was a huge John Belushi fan. I saw that movie probably much earlier than I should have, based on its content alone. But I mean, she was highly upset when he died. I mean, my mother loved John Belushi, I was exposed to that.
And John Belushi can sing the blues, man. You know, look at the artists we're exposed to in this movie: James Brown, Cab Calloway's in it, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin. That's not all, man.
Just the band, even the band.
Well, I found out later, you know, like the Steve Colonel Cropper and Duck Dunn. Yep. Those two guys were well-established musicians long before the this movie came out. These guys were in Stax Studio in Memphis, man. Legendary players, members of Booker T and the MGs, these two. This guy, McIntyre Murphy, man, played in Howlin' Wolf's band when he was very young. 20 years later, I would see him at the Old Bay Club in New Brunswick, standing 2 feet away from him.
Wow.
You know, Aretha Franklin was his old lady in the movie. Yeah. He dumped her. He left her.
Yeah.
And you better think. He just threw his apron down right at her. Shit. Walked out with friggin'
two whole chickens.
Yeah.
Dry white toast.
Without your dry white toast. Without your four fried chicken.
Elwood.
The Blues Brothers. And the band was led by none other than David Letterman's boy, man.
Paul Schaefer, man.
You know, so opens up a world. What a great movie, man.
He was the Saturday Night Live musician at that point when they formed the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
He was the lead, the band leader for SNL. That was a great pick, though, Stick. What a winner. I don't even know now. I don't remember the list, the Rolling Stone list, but you know, at the end we'll go back after our discussion.
Yeah,
that has to be on there. If that's not on there, I need to call Rolling Stone and just like
Where do the Blues Brothers and Saturday Night Fever come within Rolling Stone's list?
I know Juice. There's a movie Juice with Tupac Shakur that made the list,
mm-hmm.
And it's decent.
Yeah,
but I know Pulp Fiction was in it. Goodfellas is in it.
Yeah,
which are two that we've discussed. Right, Boogie Nights is in it. Mm-hmm. There's another one we discussed. I'm sure the Blues Brothers is in there.
Another one I love is a very underrated movie. When it first came out, it kind of flopped on release, and then it had a run on cable about a year later, and it got huge. It had developed this cult following, and I guess it remains a cult classic. But it was kind of just, it just passed unnoticed when it had its theatrical run, and that's Eddie and the Cruisers.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Yeah, it was popular when it was on HBO, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was like every day it was
got
on HBO.
Big on HBO, yeah. And HBO just played the hell out of it.
Was
and
that
just
John Cafferty did that?
John Cafferty, Beaver Brown Band. Now, the thing about that was when that was released, and I was one of many, I don't know what your memory of it is. Of hearing it on NEW when it first came out, and they kind of like made a big deal about this movie called Eddie and the Cruisers, but apparently a lot of people, myself included, thought it was a new Bruce song.
Yeah,
agreed.
Yeah,
when On the Dark Side came out,
absolutely.
They knew that, you know, Nebraska was about a year old at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody knew that Bruce was in a studio making a new rock album. It would be another year before Born in the USA came out. So, and he was notorious back then for taking a long time between albums. So when On the Dark Side came out, it kind of threw people off, saying, well, what is this?
Yeah, if you hear that on the radio for the first time, that's Bruce, right?
That opening piano and everything, absolutely.
Yeah.
It is Springsteen.
It's straight out of She's the One.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I think it's you know, Wild Summer Nights, Tender Years. I mean, it's great, great songs. John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band. We went to, I remember about 25 years back. This was like 91, 92 at the absolute latest. I remember going with some friends of mine. Chuck Shine, I'll drop your name. Name drop. Joe Shine. We were in the South River Pub, and we went to see the B Street Band.
Yeah, I've
okay,
seen them a
Bruce cover band. And we went in there and we found out that the B Street Band was not playing that week. We missed them or something. It was like the week before or it was the night before. We were there on the wrong night.
Son of a bitch.
And John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band was playing that night.
Shit.
And it was I swear to God, it was within minutes of finding all of this out. Like we got there, we realized we were there on the wrong night. Oh, no, who's playing tonight? Oh, John Cafferty. And then, like, literally a minute or two later, they took the stage On the Dark Side, and I was just like, it was so surreal. It was just kind of
the place
like,
was packed?
Whoa. Yeah, the place was packed. But it was just like being, it was like, you know, you just think Eddie and the Cruisers. You don't think John Cafferty and the Beaver Brown Band. You just know this music. You see Michael Pere's face singing.
Yeah, you don't picture John
Cafferty.
You
see Wendell on the saxophone. And, you know.
Tom Berenger playing piano.
Exactly. So
They really did bite off the Springsteen and E Street Band's image.
They modeled it right after.
Way,
it,
dude, yeah.
It should have been just the E Street Band up there, and that would have been the end of it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie, though. On a Dark Side is very high on my list of next karaoke songs I'm going to sing.
I've done it. Yeah. I've done Tender Years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've done them
both. I remember that.
Yeah, I've done them both. Heather asked me to do those. Happy birthday, Heather.
Somebody ate my cake last night.
We celebrated Heather's birthday last night in grand fashion.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah, mutual friend of ours, Heather.
You're out late, Mike, huh?
I was out late, yes. The usual Saturday night. Usual Saturday night debauchery.
Yeah.
So, this being said, rock and roll, and basically, we've been talking about songs that are in soundtracks, and I'd want to throw one out there. I have to throw it out there. It's not just, it's really just a score, but when you think of movies, iconic to me, John Williams, Star Wars is just, I have to throw it out there. I know we're just, it's still music. It's just classical music, basically, and composers. And John Williams is the guy.
Yeah.
When you want to when you want to score a movie, hey, I wonder what John Williams is doing. Let's give him a call.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got gold. Yeah. But Star Wars, to me, it's just the second you hear those horns, you're just like, fuck, that's it. It still raises the hair on my arms, and I'm fucking 46 years old.
Yeah. Which brings up the point that I think the new Star Wars movie's coming out this week.
Rogue One. I got advanced tickets to see it Thursday night.
It's very quiet, though, hype-wise, isn't it? No one's talking about this movie. Nah, it's not like the last one where it's all anyone talked about. It was so hyped up. This isn't
like an official like episode 6, 7. You know, whatever. This is kind of like an offshoot.
What's the deal of
Star Wars?
I'm the guy in the know.
This is the guy. This is
the
guy. Yeah. This is a
prequel to actually Star Wars. This is before Star Wars. Star Wars starts out with Leia giving R2 those plans of the Death Star.
All right,
get him to Obi-Wan Kenobi. Help us, Obi-Wan Kenobi. Your only hope. Yeah. Rogue One is how they acquired the plans to destroy the Death Star. I read today, because they had the L.A. premiere last night, Kevin Smith, Jersey boy Kevin Smith, love you, much love to Kevin Smith, Clerks, the whole nine yards. He went to see it with his daughter last night and said that this is the movie that every Star Wars fan has been waiting for.
Yeah.
I am locked in. Before Episode 7 last year, I was excited to see it. J.J. Abrams can't go wrong, blah, blah, blah. I've been more excited about this film than Episode 7. I think it's going to be 10 times better than Episode 7.
Yeah, really?
10 times better. Cannot wait for this movie.
It's a mouthful. People love that last movie.
Kevin Smith said Vader in this movie is unlike... He said the last act, the final act of this movie is probably the best thing that you've wanted since Star Wars. He said it's as good as Empire Strikes Back.
We'll see.
The hype is there for this film, and I cannot wait.
I'm deeply skeptical, Pat.
I will talk about it on the next episode.
That's
going
to be on that level of awesome. Doubt it.
I think Episode 7 was basically just Star Wars with better special effects and a new director.
I did not think as highly of it as everybody else did. People made it sound like a life-changing movie. People need to chill.
No, I agree with that to a degree. Here's why I really liked it. Because it took kids my daughter's age, 13 and younger, 12 and younger, and reintroduced them. It gave those kids the feeling that we had when we went to see Star Wars.
I think it kind of did.
It did. It absolutely did. Because if you look at the original Star Wars, as near and dear as it was to us, it has not aged well as a film. It's quite boring, to be honest with you. I watch it and I'm just like,
you think?
It's dated. It's very dated.
Think?
I do. I absolutely. And I love the movie. To me, that you can't get better than the original trilogy.
Yeah.
But if you show that to a kid these days, they're so... and you guys are the wordsmiths. They're so used to seeing things.
Digital imagery? Is that where you're going? That looks fake.
You
know, Pat, I disagree with them. I think the digital shit looks fake compared to
puppets or whatever. It was all props. I mean, they added digital stuff at the end of it. But he used practical props like the original Star Wars. I guess it's just the film, whatever it was, the dialogue, whatever it was. Riley fell asleep during Star Wars.
Yeah.
The original 77 Star Wars, she fell asleep during it. Episode 7, she absolutely loved it. It reintroduced kids to it gave those kids the same feeling we had growing up.
But maybe that's part of my problem. Is there so much action in the new versions as compared to the old one? There's quiet moments in the original Star Wars. Maybe the new ones have more things exploding, you know?
They definitely did.
Which doesn't make for a great movie, in my opinion. I'd rather have, you know, more introspection, more dialogue than action, you know? You gotta balance it out.
Those quiet moments mean a lot in a film.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that gives you time to digest what you just saw. And I agree. I definitely agree. I mean, as a film, as a film fan, I agree with everything you said. But I also, they Disney now owns Star Wars, and they said, look,
that's
we
dangerous.
Need to reintroduce this.
Yeah.
I'm happy because they're going to throw a lot of money at it. I'm okay with them owning it. And so far, so good. After Rogue One, I'll talk to you Friday, and I'll say, hey, Stick, they hit a home run. And you're going to be like, well, okay, now I got to go see it.
But now that it's been Disney-fied, there's an interest in developing characters that will sell well as action figures. You know, we have to have the cute one.
George even did that, though. And when he still owned the property in the later movies, he was, he admittedly so.
It didn't take long.
For his kids. Yeah. It was, you know.
That didn't take long. That was full on by Return of the Jedi.
Empire Strikes Back was the best movie of the any Star Wars saga movie.
I might agree with you about that, bro. Empire was the bomb, dude. I might agree with you.
Yeah,
100%. It had everything in it.
And
movie.
We're all the same age. We're all like, you know, we're purists, and we were there from the beginning. So
Jedi was great without the Ewoks. Take that Ewok. Take the whole Ewok thing out of there. Jedi was great. Mm-hmm. They could have filled that space with other things, and I would have been like, Jedi was. Close second.
Yeah.
You know, getting back to the original thought is that John Williams, it doesn't necessarily have to be the the Vader scenes, the Imperial March.
Yeah.
All of that. You just feel it in your blood and in your bones, and you're like, this is great.
And you put that on your record, and you feel that in your living room, man.
Oh,
you
do. You know, I have a really, really good surround sound system, and when we watch that, and that scroll is going up my TV, and and you just hear it, and it's so dynamic. I love it. Riley's school band played it last year at their spring concert.
Wow.
Not that whole, not the whole piece. They bunched it like a part of a whole bunch of parts of it together. It was great. I was just so in love with those kids up there playing that soundtrack. It was just so great to hear them play it.
If you're on like great American composers of, you know, the big film scores like John Williams, you can't forget Jerry Goldsmith, who did you know, he did a bunch of the Star Trek movies and, you know, the big one that I love was one of my favorite movies ever is Chinatown, which has got one of the most the greatest scores ever.
Yeah,
and it's just like a lot of like really like film noirish trumpet and just like real smoky jazz 1930s era.
Good way. Smoky jazz.
A guy named Yuan Racy, a very little known trumpet player, and he played with Sinatra. And Henry Mancini, he did Peter Gunn. He did the trumpet on, you know, when those scenes, those key scenes in Chinatown where that reoccurring melody comes back, you know, in the beginning, and it happens a couple times in the movie. So that's him playing that.
Well, speaking of good movies and soundtracks to go with it, there's a cult classic that you guys know and love, and you overlooked it, didn't you? Talking about The Warriors. It's a great soundtrack, man. I just watched it for the first time. For the first time in like 20 years. About 6 months ago. No, it's been a long time.
Joe Walsh, man.
Joe Walsh is in the city. That comes right to mind.
When with the opening note to that song, when they were looking out on that water. Uh-huh. Cha-tang, cha-tang, it's perfect, lined up perfect.
Mm-hmm. Listen to the Warriors theme song, it's called, man. This one jam. They use it for the montages in the movie where the boys are like, they're walking through this nighttime dystopian New York on their way back to Coney Island. And the Warriors theme song, it's called, is the soundtrack to those moments, man. You know, them trying to make their way home.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, man. It ebbs and flows, man. It has a real 70s sounding slap bass bam, 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 on the wah pedal. Combined with spooky shit. And then it's bam, and bam, in your face. Dear listener, I'm telling you. Go on YouTube. Listen to the Warriors soundtrack. You'll be going to your nearest Sam Goodyear Corvette store and buying the album or the 8-track tomorrow.
Hey there, all you boppers. Get this Warriors soundtrack.
Yeah, I had it on. I was telling Nicole, man, we got to get the soundtrack. This is good shit.
A soundtrack I would love to get my hands on if it does, in fact, exist. Speaking of film scores... A movie called Picnic at Hanging Rock. Does that ring a bell?
It rings a bell. I'm at the soundtrack, though.
Exactly. It's not a soundtrack that you go out and find in Tower Records or anything like that. Again, I don't even know if there is a soundtrack available.
Sam
but
Goody.
Do you remember in the 70s? You're going to laugh. In the 70s, like before infomercials were infomercials, there were always those artists that they just like announced were super huge, but you never heard of them, but they supposedly sold millions of records worldwide. Like
Leo Sayer.
Burl Ives.
Burl Ives.
Zamfir, the pan flute.
Yeah.
Zamfir, the pan flute guy.
Pan flute. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Zamfir did in Picnic at Hanging Rock, and it's just like this really mystical, haunting flute.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And a lot of like, I guess harpsichord, not harpsichord, but just like organ. Look it up on YouTube. It's called The Ascent Music. It's one scene where the girls are going up Hanging Rock and they're going into, you know, they basically disappear. These girls go on a picnic at Hanging Rock, this geological formation in Australia, and they're told not to climb the rock. You know, it's just this eerie looking rock.
True story, right?
This is, well, it's based on a true story. Yeah. And they just disappeared.
Girls disappear.
They disappeared.
How many?
I guess 5.
Yeah. Nah, I saw the movie with
four
you.
Four disappeared and one made it back. It's
we were
crazy,
both impressed.
Man.
We walked out of that theater like, whoa.
I always felt that the movie gets really boring after 35 minutes. I always thought it was like at the 35-minute mark, and whenever, like, once the girls disappear, and then you see, and the one girl, like, you could look for this on YouTube. I always thought it should have just been a short film, and it should have just ended where it,
yeah,
where the girl screams and the camera pans up and it goes over to this aerial view and you see the girl running down the mountain, down the rock. But The Ascent Music, it's called, and I actually stole it for our Nuremberg episode. If you listen to the Nuremberg episode, when we're talking about Kate Bush, the music in the background is that music.
I was wondering what that was.
So, yeah, I would love to get my hands on that soundtrack.
Yeah. All right, so see, we can go deep, too. We can go real deep in Archie Fartsy if you want us to. I got one for you, man. Thanks to my buddy, Robbie Catafalmo. I am aware of the dark world of the American filmmaker Kenneth Anger.
Right.
Anger films, you may be aware, Mike, are deeply surreal, right? Sexual, bizarre, right? Symbolic, occult. Robbie turned me on to one called Lucifer Rising, right? Again, 30-minute movie. Not for everybody, for the reasons I mentioned. You know, bizarre stuff, really occult imagery. Not for everybody, but you still got to try it. You know, you got to try it. But Kenneth Anger, for this dark, mysterious soundtrack, turns to none other than Jimmy Page from Zeppelin, right? Because they have a couple things in common. They're both interested in the occult, in particular Aleister Crowley. We know that Jimmy Page just moved into Aleister Crowley's old place, which I found out is on Loch Ness in Scotland. He commissions Jimmy Page to do the soundtrack for Lucifer Rising. Apparently, Jimmy Page thinks that one room of his place is haunted by the ghost of a headless guy, and he has the idea that if he records the soundtrack in this room, that will exorcise the ghost of the headless guy from this room. Heroin's great shit, right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know if it worked or not, but the score is by Page. But they have a falling out, man. Anger and Page have a falling out, right? He decides, we're not going to use Jimmy Page's score after all. Going to turn that job now over to a guy by the name of Bobby Beausoleil. Bobby Beausoleil, as it turns out, was one of the Manson murderers. He was there, yeah. And he actually was a musician of no small regard, man. Like, if you listen to both, I think the Beausoleil version is even better, you know? Dark,
crazy. Page's version ever made it to the film?
No, he shit-canned it, but apparently the Page version, you can still get it.
You can find it. I've always known about Lucifer Rising. I didn't know the connection to later, you know, to the Anger.
Which one is better, Bobby Beausoleil or Page, is up to you. You decide, right? But bizarre, again, occult. Homoerotic movies and sounds, but tasty. Very well done. Very well done. You can put it on and enjoy it. It's not discordant. You know, it kind of draws you in.
Yeah.
Dark and wonderful.
Hmm.
Kenneth Anger. He's got Scorpio Rising too, man. And you know, in the Lucifer Rising, Marianne Faithfull's in it too. Marianne Faithfull's in the movie. Mick Jagger was supposed to play the part of Lucifer, but turned it down and gave it to his brother, Chris Jagger. These are all things I know about it, which Kenneth Anger did not like. He wanted Mick Jagger,
I'm wondering
Chris Jagger.
If in the arms benefit. Do you remember the Ronnie Lane appeal to arms? It was for multiple sclerosis.
No, dude.
And it was a benefit that they did in 1983. And Ronnie Lane had his friends put together, you know, from the Yardbirds. It was Jeff Beck and Eric Clapton and Andy Fairweather Lowe and Steve Winwood, Kenny Jones, Ron Wood, and Jimmy Page came out, and it was the first time that he had made an appearance, a public appearance, since John Bonham died and Zeppelin broke up. It was his first time. He was bad. He was like rail thin.
Yeah.
He was still struggling with addiction. And he played something, and it may be what he wrote for that film.
Yeah.
Yeah. He may have played a part of Lucifer Rising.
It's long, droney, and repetitive.
It was some. You know what? Don't quote me on it. Got to look it up.
Really interesting music.
So now we've discussed quite a few albums, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's see what's made our list, the Rolling Stones list.
Well, let's look at this. Let's scrutinize.
How keyed in are we?
The Vanilla Magazine.
Yeah. Head, the Monkees movie.
Head, the Monkees movie.
Yeah, it's a psychedelic fantasy. I've never even heard of it.
I never saw it.
No. It bombed, apparently. It was co-written by Jack Nicholson, and Frank Zappa is in it.
Nicholson, now what year was that?
Does not say. Oh, 68.
Nicholson was off his fucking nut
he was
in 1968.
Smoking a lot of drugs.
Between him and Peter Fonda, man. Yeah. And, you know,
he was doing a lot of weird shit.
Yeah. Psych Out and The Trip.
Yeah.
And this was before Easy Rider, man.
Number 24 was 1979's Rock and Roll High School.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Number 23 was Juice. That was from 1992. That had some Tupac Shakur, EPMD, Big Daddy Kane, Eric B. and Rakim, Cypress Hill, a bunch of stuff that you guys wouldn't know.
Yeah.
2003's Lost in Translation. You know, that I fell asleep twice during that movie. I just could not get through that movie.
See, I don't like it. I never saw it.
Bill Murray and
I only fell asleep once.
I didn't try to watch it again. Yeah. There was so much hype about it.
You're a better man than me.
I had to give it another shot. That's Woody Coppola's daughter, by the way. Sophia Coppola directed that. Number 21 was 24-Hour Party People from 2002.
I've seen that. A lot of post-punk music.
Yeah.
Joy Division stuff.
Yeah. Number 20 was Singles. That was from 92.
There you go, Pat.
That was one of mine. Number 19 was The Magical Mystery Tour. None of us mentioned any of the Beatles movies, which is interesting. That was 67.
Yeah, there's something to be said about that, though.
A given?
I'll save that for our Beatles. Now, you know what? I don't think I know it's a soundtrack, but a lot of people think of Magical Mystery Tour as a legitimate studio album.
I do.
And it's been accepted.
I do.
And I think, I don't know if there's a consensus on that, but I think the consensus might be that it's just a studio album. I don't know. I don't think of it as a soundtrack.
I don't think of
it. Although it is.
Okay.
It is.
Yeah. I never think of a movie when you're right.
Help is a soundtrack, too.
That's on this
list. Yeah.
Number 18, 97's Boogie Nights.
There you go.
That was like a mixtape, too, that movie. It really was the soundtrack.
I got to see it. I loved it when it came out. I haven't seen it since.
Yeah, it is Sister Christian. Yeah, it's whenever Night Ranger's Sister Christian comes on at happy hour, you can almost smell freebase sweat and firecracker smoke. number 17, American Graffiti from 73. Number 16.
50s music in there.
Yeah. Number 16, The Graduate. That was 68.
Yeah.
Simon and Garfunkel.
Number 15, Goodfellas from 1990. We've all mentioned that.
Uh-huh.
Number 14, Easy Rider. There's some more.
Have that
Jack
in the shelf.
Nicholson.
You know it.
Where does West Side Story fit into this?
Number 13, Train Spotting. That's one of those movies that I'm just like, yeah, okay, whatever.
Is that British music like Blur and Oasis, or no? Am I just way off?
Damon Albarn, Bedrock, Blur, Elastica, Brian Eno.
Oh, yeah, see, I might have something there.
New Order, Iggy Pop.
Okay.
Primal Scream, Lou Reed.
Oh, all right. I like it. I like Primal Scream.
I didn't like Trainspotting.
And Lou Reed.
Number 12, Wild Style. That was from 1983. I'm thinking that's breakdancing stuff.
Never heard of that.
I didn't hear that one either. That one got me. Pretty in Pink. I mean, in 2000, number 10, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Mm-hmm.
Love the movie. The soundtrack, You look at me and you don't think bluegrass.
No.
You're like, that guy doesn't listen to bluegrass. But
I'm a
it
man
just
of constant
works.
Sorrow, man. That's yeah. the song.
Oh, it's a great, soundtrack.
The Soggy Bottom Boys is what they were calling themselves. Yeah. It just works.
That's one of the. It's one of those movies where I don't like. I don't care for the movie, but I like the soundtrack.
Love the movie. I love everything
yeah.
about it.
Yeah.
That's the Coen brothers. Just those guys yeah. are just so out there.
I think they're hit or miss with me. I'm not a huge
yeah,
Coen brothers
Yeah, I agree.
Fan.
I'm a hit or miss. Hit or miss.
Yeah.
Produced by T-Bone Burnett, by the way.
Yeah, well, T-Bone, yeah. he's royalty.
Number nine, this is Spinal Tap.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That All definitely right. deserves to be up that high.
Hellhole.
Number eight was Rushmore.
Good stuff.
Number seven, Pulp Fiction. We all mentioned
there
that
you
one.
Go, Pat.
Superfly, 1972. You got it over there, Stick. Look at him. Yeah.
I had a 20-minute speech prepared for this. I'll spare you it. Superfly, Curtis Mayfield. Baby.
Number five, Saturday Night Fever, 1977. Number four, A Hard Day's Night by them boys from overseas.
The Bee Gees?
Number three, The Harder They Come.
See, I think that's overrated.
72.
I don't like that. I don't. The Jimmy Cliff, The Harder They Come. I don't like the movie or the soundtrack very much.
Number two.
But number two, I like a lot.
I can't believe we all missed this
Purple
one.
Rain?
Purple Rain, yeah. That's deservedly so. 84. Man, we're old.
You know why I said, you know how I knew Purple Rain? Because Purple Rain is always number two on every fucking Rolling Stones list. Every Rolling Stones
Dude,
list ever fucking
Rain.
Compiled, Purple Rain is always number two.
Now that he's dead,
no matter what the list
one.
Is, it's always
yeah,
number
bump,
two.
They'll bump him up and up.
Yeah.
Number one, 1965, Help, The Beatles. That one, I don't know.
Yeah,
I really don't
agree
with that
one. I don't know
if
that's number one.
Nope, I agree. I think Pulp Fiction should be higher. I think Goodfellas should be higher. And I think Purple Rain should probably be number one.
That ain't even the number one Beatles album.
Seriously, I agree, boys.
And that's Rolling Stone's take on albums. I just, you know, once I found out we were doing the topic, I said, let me see what they have to say on the subject.
I got one or two more they didn't talk about.
Yes.
Mike, do you remember when I had this phase, every little get-together I have with all the friends and family, I put this record on?
Deep Throat Part 2.
The Deep Throat soundtrack with Linda Lovelace. You people out there in podcast land cannot see, I actually have the actual copy right here with Linda Lovelace on the cover. You know, the original Deep Throat was such a smash. Actually, I was watching a documentary about the 70s on Netflix. They were saying, like, Ordinary, like, Housewives, and, like, everybody went to see Deep Throat. Like, Ordinary, like, people, like, went to their local fucking porn fucking palace.
It was kind of the equivalent of 50 Shades of Grey, where everybody was just, like, kind of curiously, yeah. like, diving into,
yeah.
oh, what's this?
Yeah. So,
but not never, like, never really admitting to it.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, just look at this boy.
Congressman Jones, I saw you at Deep Throat last night. Uh-huh.
If you see this sitting on a shelf of the store, you're not going to leave it there. You're going to buy this. I bought it. I listened to it last night, literally, because it's been a long time. I remember it being more upbeat, but it really wasn't. It's kind of like maudlin and down, like, yeah. I don't know, but nevertheless, a really fantastic album.
I'll tell you one thing. That album wasn't making Rolling Stones top 25.
And one more. There's one more. Am I taking up too much time with this?
No, I'm waving this fucking yeah, around.
You know, yeah, dust bunny
came out of
by.
The album when you waved it in front of my face. Yeah.
There's no dust coming out of Linda Lovelace.
That's how long he hasn't listened to it, man. It had so much dust down. Triggered an allergy attack now. I'm going to die on the air.
What do you got?
Something happened. This is a couple months ago. I'm reading a book or something, and I see the author makes a reference to the movie Blade Runner.
Mm.
All right? Then it happens again. I'm reading like a book or a magazine. I see like Blade Runner again. If I'm lying, I'm flying. I'm hanging out with Ma, whatever. That same week, we're watching Jeopardy, and the correct answer is, what is Blade Runner? Like, I was like, it came up like three times randomly. Like, I know this movie is like a cult, a science fiction classic.
Yeah. Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm curious about this. Like, I got to see this freaking movie now.
This thing is a little overrated.
I got to see this Blade Runner.
It's a cult classic.
Yeah, yeah. I got to see Blade Runner. Like, Cole said, that's on Netflix right now.
It's very like pleasant to look at. You know, it's just like the colors and it's like this real dark, dingy. Like the whole
right.
movie, it's like always pouring rain.
I think I like that
movie,
about it.
Yet there's
like
all
that
these
dingy
like,
atmosphere.
Almost like you're going through Tokyo. Like all the like
right.
the colors of Tokyo.
You nailed it, bro.
But it's like this like it's kind of like like what Iron Maiden did for their concept for
Somewhere
in Time.
In time.
They did
yes.
that based on Blade Runner, and
they did, huh?
Yeah, They kind of described it as a Blade Runner like feel or concept, but yeah, you know, I think it's a little bit overrated as a film, but just I still like the look of it.
Yeah, I like the look of it, but the soundtrack, dude, is gorgeous, man. I was thinking as we were, that's the one thing I do remember. I was like, this is a good soundtrack, huh? Very French sounding to me. Like heavy keyboards, warm and comforting. You just want to like lay in bed. It's languid and slow and smooth and nice and long. If you're having a party and it's late and you want your guests to kind of like tone down, right? You know, we're coming down now. Put on that soundtrack, man.
You know what I thought was a really cool little piece of information. I got this, you know, obviously years and years ago, but as a Stanley Kubrick fan, and the very first conversation we ever had, me and Pat, was Stanley Kubrick. That's how we met. We met over a Stanley Kubrick conversation.
Oh, yeah. You guys are boyfriends ever since.
out in a parking lot. But the footage at the very end, like the closing credits of Blade Runner, you see like the sky. And it's like this, like almost like aerial footage where it's going through mountains, and you see the sky, and you see like it's passing like mountains and trees and stuff. That's leftover footage from The Shining.
Oh no shit!
Oh yeah,
yeah, like the helicopter footage at the intro of The Shining. That's
that makes sense.
That's what was used. That same footage was used for the end of Blade Runner.
I had no idea. That's interesting.
I read that the Blade Runner is in the Library of the United States Congress for being aesthetically or historically relevant or something like that. It's considered important for whatever reason, you know. Mm. It's got Harrison Ford in it. It's aesthetically nice. It's very, you know, just, yeah, it's stoner friendly.
Well, there you have it, kids. There's
there you have it.
That's our show.
Music and movies. Like peanut butter and chocolate.
We're going to thank everybody for playing.
I'd like to thank everybody. Chuck, tell them what parting gifts we have for them.
Well, we have a nice fine dining room set made of the finest fabulous formica circa 1973.
You have the bamboo steamer.
Second prize is a set of steak knives. Would you like to see third prize?
This set retails for $999.99.
Everybody, we'd like to thank everybody for tuning in, supporting our podcast. Please, for the love of Christ, again, go to iTunes and rate and review us. If you have an Apple account, you can do this. Thank you.
Yes.
That's our show. Anyway, we have one more show coming up for the rest of the year for 2016, and then we could just lay this fucking year to rest.
I want to say a little happy holiday message to everybody, too, man.
Yeah.
That's right.
Merry Christmas. Be safe.
We don't get our next episode out before the holidays, although we will have an episode out during the holidays.
Just say no. You can do it. Buy people gifts. Be generous. You got the money. Don't be cheap. Gift cards are nice.
We're done, right?
See you guys.
Bye. She long.